Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, talking bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. This is the second part of episode 24, which was all about Warhammer fantasy role-playing, Wuffrup, and it includes all the bits that didn't quite fit into the first part. It's not a supplement, it's more of a director's cut of an old favourite. The Grognard Files is brought to you by the Armchair Adventurers, a group of gamers who used to be active in the early to late 80s and then went into a deep freeze, and have defrosted into a whole new world. Thank you to everyone who's been sharing their experiences of playing Warhammer back in the day and today, and we're always very grateful for feedback and hearing your stories. We've had another iTunes review, which is great because it alerts the mind slaves of Apple that we still exist, and they'll send their algorithms mithering some poor, unsuspecting soul. This one is from Alistair D. I started listening to the Grognard Files back in July, and I liked it so much that I've listened to nothing else on my commutes to and from work. Dirk and Blythe are great company with their ready wit and guiding hand down memory lane. As an RPGer back in the day, this podcast has really connected with me. And the hosts, along with Ed and the Daily Dwarf, feel like old friends. They're forward-thinking too, embracing the new as well as the old, prompting me to do the same. Thanks, lads. If you're ever in the northeast of England, let me know. The first round is on me. Thanks for that, Alistair, and thanks for the offer of beer. Beer is always appreciated. Graham Davis returns to this episode. He's had a long career as an RPG writer, and in The Games Master Screen, he talks about some of its highlights. I've done links in the show notes if you want to explore some of the projects he mentions for yourself. His blog is also a good source of links to his back catalogue. At Daily Dwarf from Twitter and Armchair Adventurer Extraordinaire has been burning the midnight oil once again, looking at the back issues of White Dwarf to study some of the great Wuffrup adventures that appeared in the magazine. Since the last podcast, Blythe and I have finally had a couple of games, thanks to Gaz from the Smart Party, who took us on a tour of the Volksfest at Mittelburg to enjoy Lips and Snout sausage, and let's face it, I've had worse. Gaz used the new 4th edition rules from Cubicle 7, and we had a tremendous time scratching the surface of nobility to unleash chaos. We've also played the 1st edition with Asaka So from Twitter. More about that next time. In this episode, we open the box on Warhammer and try and work out why we've never played it and how we can fit it into our repertoire now that there's so much stuff. I'll be back at the end to critically injure new patrons. Until then, ramblers, let's get rambling.
Gamesmaster Screen!
Welcome to the Gamesmaster Screen. I'm just going to put this screen between me and Graham Davis. Welcome back, Graham.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Okay, so I'm going to put this... Now, this is a Vampire the Masquerade screen. I think you had some involvement in Vampire in the early days, didn't you?
I did, yes. After, when I was thinking of leaving Games Workshop, Ken Ralston, who'd done some writing, including Something Rotten in Kislev for the Enemy Within campaign, he put me in touch with this young fella called Mark Reinhagen in the States, who had this revolutionary idea of a game where all the players are vampires. We talked a little bit, and after I moved to the States a few months later, I ended up seeing and commenting on some initial drafts of the rules and contributing to some of the core books and editing some of the others. In short, I was involved in just about everything that came out in the first couple of years for in one way or another. And in fact, my very first Gen Con, 1991, I was a guest of White Wolf when they launched Vampyre.
I know that you said that you were disappointed perhaps in the direction that it took. It never, that it went into the factions rather than the nastiness of being a vampire. Is that right?
The particular, everybody has their own particular view of vampires and expectations of vampire fiction and games and what have you. I really like the subtitle of Vampyre as a storytelling game of personal horror, and they had this really nice humanity mechanic, so that what you did as a vampire affected your humanity, and you had to stay at least somewhat human, because if your humanity reached zero, you became entirely monstrous and an NPC. I was very interested in the psychology of vampirism, finding yourself being a vampire, confronting the moral and psychological challenges. That was a part of the early products, but then as they developed the different clans and factions and politics and so on, and I think as well as Anne Rice became more mainstream and the 90s vampire took over from the previous generation of vampires, and an element of soap opera really kind of pervaded the whole genre, which persists to this day, I found that a little less interesting and challenging. But I must say, having seen a copy of the new, I think it's 5th edition Vampire the Masquerade, it looks promising. There's a lot of new mechanics and stuff. Not everybody's going to like it. Some people have already been shocked by some of the content. But for those who want to explore the moral and psychological aspects and what that does to a person, it's all there in those rules for you to use. So I'm quite heartened by that.
Yeah, bring back some blood into it. That's good. Yeah. So I'm gonna roll on this table. I've got a table in front of me that's got some highlights from your long and prolific career for us to talk about. Okay. So first up, I'm going to roll this apparently at random. Here we go. And it's number 3. And this is a subject close to my heart. It's Imagine and your contribution to Imagine magazine. So we had Paul Coburn on the Grog Pod in the past, and he said that you were a stalwart at the heart of Imagine. You know, he thought it would be impossible to produce Imagine without you being part of it. So that must be gratifying.
That's pretty kind of him.
And the other point is that your contributions to Imagine had such an influence on my games. What you used to do is put a lot of historical background stuff that I wasn't aware of, and I used to pepper it into my game. So how did you feel that? Because you really did produce some great essays on historical background for Imagine.
Well, thank you. My involvement with Imagine started before it came out, actually, because there was an ad in White Dwarf for an editor for a new magazine for TSR UK. Which, of course, was the job Paul Coburn got. I applied for that. I don't think I've told anybody that before. But I was at college. I was doing postgrad work, and for various reasons, I was getting a little jaded with academia in general. And I was looking around, and I thought, well, you know, I'm spending most of my time playing games as it is. I wonder if I could make a living of it. And so I applied when this job became a when this ad came out, and didn't get it, but then I saw the first issue of Imagine. I'd already written a few things for White Dwarf by that time, so I wrote asking, you know, what they wanted in the way of contributors. Paul wrote me a very nice letter back. Two things really sealed the deal for me. One was that they had themes to their issues. I wasn't just shooting in the dark like I was with White Dwarf, sending articles in and hoping they liked them, but that I had something to guide me and also to take ideas from. The second was they paid twice as much. They paid tuppence a word instead of a penny. anyway, over the years, 2.5, 3 years that Imagine was published, yeah, I became quite a regular. Paul would tell me what the theme of a certain issue was. I'd come up with usually 4 or 5 ideas. He'd pick his favourite. Occasionally, like the Far East issue, I got three articles in the same issue of the magazine, which was
that issue in particular had a tremendous influence on how I played games. I think it was through that, and I should thank you for that. Is I discovered Kurosawa, and I just wanted to thank you for that because I've turned into a Japanophile ever since then.
Oh, well, thanks. I mean, Japan was everywhere in the 80s. You know, there was the Shogun miniseries. There was Kurosawa brought out Kagemusha and Ran, two fantastic and visually ravishing movies. There was all the new romantics with Japanese writing on their T-shirts. And my girlfriend at the time had one of those, and walking around Durham, she came upon a coach full of Japanese tourists who looked at her shirt and started giggling. After some questioning, she was able to find out that the writing on her T-shirt actually said, "I take in laundry." So beware wearing anything with writing on that you can't read.
Yeah.
And then, of course, in the gaming world, we had Bushido, which was the first one. The first Japanese role-playing game, which really sort of opened my eyes to the possibilities of historical role-playing and role-playing as a tool to explore other times and cultures. And then AD&D Oriental Adventures came out, RuneQuest Land of Ninja, GURPS Japan. And it was, if you weren't there in the 80s, boys and girls, it was a real thing. You know, the fascination with Japan and Japanese culture was everywhere.
Just before we move to the next thing on the table, just thank you for everything you did for Imagine, because it was tremendously influential. So let me roll again. This time it's four, and it's related, actually. So historical role-playing source books that you did for GURPS.
You know, one of the things that Imagine did for me with their themed issues was allowed me to leverage my what I'd learned at college studying archaeology and ancient history. And so when I left Games Workshop to become full-time freelance, one of the first things I did was pitch some historical source books to other publishers. The first one I signed was GURPS Vikings. Here's a little bit of trivia for you. Steve Jackson of Steve Jackson Games, who is, of course, different from the Steve Jackson of Fighting Fantasy, he's a member of the SCA, the Society for Creative Anachronism, and his character in there is a Viking, and he's always been fascinated by Viking culture and history and stuff. So on the one hand, this was an easy sell, but on the other hand, the manuscript was viewed with quite a critical eye. And he had a lot of comments, and between us, we made GURPS Vikings what it was. And when that was successful, they were looking for someone to do one on medieval England, which I did. At the same time, or slightly earlier, TSR had been putting out the HR historical reference series for AD&D. The first one was Vikings. The second one, I think, was Charlemagne's Paladins. I'm not sure. But anyway, I pitched them one on the Celts, so I got to write that one as well. And since then, GURPS Vikings and Middle Ages 1, as it was called, went into second editions, which I rewrote and expanded. I've worked on various other historical bits and bobs ever since.
The GURPS source books remain very collectible, don't they? And I think Robin D. Laws recommends that you just close your eyes and pull two source books off the shelf and create an adventure from merging the two.
That's not a bad idea, and that's a pretty good idea from a man who has very few bad ideas. And but he's right. There are, you know, even if you don't play GURPS, the amount of information in them and the way it's presented make them great references and very digestible. You can you can draw a lot of inspiration from them.
I'm going to start work on my Vikings in Medieval England campaign as soon as we finish. So, okay. I've rolled a seven, and that's The Creatures of Freeport.
Oh, yes. That's going back a bit. Yes, when Green Ronin brought out their Freeport setting for D20, I was absolutely fascinated. It was a nice blend of two genres. It reminded me in a way of Shadowrun way back when, how that was the first sort of genre blending game, which took a cyberpunk, which was moderately fashionable at the time, and threw fantasy races in there. At first it looked as if they just didn't care, but then when you read the background it made perfect sense. And Freeport, a nice blend of genres, fantasy plus pirates, you can't really lose with that. And also, as it happened, it was very similar to something I'd been hoping to do for Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, which never came to pass. Some of the Doomstones adventures and maybe a couple of other things that I worked on for Flame, I put in seeded little mentions of a town called Socotra, a pirate port somewhere way past the Border Princes down to the southeast, a lawless place and where, you know, men and orcs tolerated each other. And all that aside, Freeport just seemed very interesting. I got the source book and read it through, and I'd been talking to Chris Pramus of Green Ronin. First, I did an adventure collection called Tales of Freeport. Some of it was good and some of it wasn't so good. Anyway, you can find out online and make your own mind up. But Creatures of Freeport was something quite dear to my heart. In the first place, because I got to work with Keith Baker, a game designer I'd known for some time, and I'd actually worked with in two different companies. In video games, and he went on to create the Eberron setting for D&D. We collaborated on this. We've been looking for a project to work on together, and one of the things I wanted to do was to expand what a monster description was. You know, instead of like two paragraphs of text and a stat block and a picture, include things like if you make your background lore, your scholarship role, what do you know about this thing? After you've killed it, what bits are useful to alchemists and wizards, and how much are they worth? What sort of tactics does this creature employ in an encounter? How does its mind work? What does it do? Also, because I always like to do this, three or four little adventure seeds just to inspire you to use the thing. So with that expanded setting, expanded format rather, a limited number of monsters, Keith and I produced Creatures of Freeport, and I've always been very pleased with it.
I wasn't aware of that supplement, and it sounds right up my street, because like you, part of my love of role playing came out of watching the Harryhausen movies, and monsters have always for me been key to role playing games, and I never think there's enough attention really given to monsters.
That's right. You know, if it's just a box with a bunch of numbers and you knock it down, it's not very interesting. Whereas if you know where it comes from, why it's there, how it works, you can set up far more interesting and challenging encounters as a GM. And if there's the information's available to a player character, like, you know, okay, I make my scholarship roll, what do I know about this thing? It just makes everything so much more dimensional and creates a feeling of reality in the world.
Well, I'm definitely going on my wish list. That, thanks for that, Graham. I'm going to roll again, and I've got eight this time, and it's Osprey Adventures and Dark Osprey.
Oh yes, yeah. Round about 2011 to 2016, I think it was, Osprey did a very, very bold thing. Of course, everybody knows them for their military history books. And, you know, if you want to know what color the fly buttons are on every regiment that fought at Waterloo, they're the people to tell you. Under the leadership of a guy called Joseph McCulloch, they expanded into a more fantasy direction. Osprey Adventures was a division they launched with two product lines in it. One was called Myth and Folklore, Myth and Legend rather. Really trying to take a chunk, I think, out of the Time Life market. You know, it was high quality books on mythology with gorgeous illustrations, as you would rely on from Osprey. And they hired me to write two books. I did one about Thor and one about Theseus and the Minotaur, and had a great time doing both of those. And they, the rest of that line is fantastic as well. They've covered, you know, Hercules, obviously Jason and the Argonauts, Odin, dragon slayers from all kinds of mythology everywhere, King Arthur, lots and lots of stuff. If you're a mythology fan, and I can't think of any better place to find a quick but detailed and very very usable overview of a particular character or mythology, accompanied by just fantastic illustrations culled from the image libraries of the world, and also including probably 5 or 6 or 8 plates per book, completely original, done by some really great artists. The other line under the Osprey Adventures brand was called Dark Osprey, and this is far more dark and fantastical, and possibly of more interest to gamers. The first book in there was called Zombies, A Hunter's Guide. Joe wrote it himself, and it was this fictional history of zombie wars, and it set up a specialist anti-zombie unit of the US Army, and examined other countries and tactics, and it was really fun. I wrote one on werewolves that I borrowed his specialist anti-supernatural special forces regiment for that, and divided the werewolves into 5 categories according to various qualities that I came across culling the literature, the movies, the medieval trials, and all of that. That was a lot of fun. I also wrote a book on Templar conspiracies for that line, putting together every Templar conspiracy I could find, from, you know, the Holy Blood to the Holy Grail, and the Holy Grail to whatever all else is going on. To they've cropped up in so many movies and books, it's impossible to list them all. But I put together everything I could find, and then constructed an overarching fiction so that everything could be true at once. And then the final title I did for them was on the Nazi moon base, which...
Brilliant.
That's right. I couldn't resist having a crack at Iron Sky, because their base was in the form of a swastika, which, of course, is one of the least efficient designs for getting from one end of a building to another. And having it on the dark side of the moon meant you couldn't actually see the Earth, much less bombard it or plan to invade it. Anyway, I put in had a lot of fun doing that. I culled all the research on Nazi UFOs and all of that. Put in a couple of sly references to Captain America and Castle Wolfenstein and various other bits and bobs, and that was a lot of fun too. Kenneth Haidt, whose name you probably know, did a great companion volume on the Nazi occult, and between the two of them you could derive a very nice campaign for Actum Cthulhu or any other sort of weird war.
Delta Green, that kind of thing, yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh. And are they still in print, Graham?
They are still in print. They haven't produced any new titles for a while, sadly, as Frostgrave has taken off in a big way and demands a lot of support. And they're putting out a lot of little one-off games. Gaslands, a vehicle combat game, which if you remember Dark Future from Games Workshop, or Car Wars from Steve Jackson Games, it's similar to that. And one of my favorites is a skirmish game called Of Gods and Mortals, where you can it's a mythological game, and you base your warband on having a god as a leader and mythical heroes as elite troops, and then more historical troops as the bulk of the warband. I'm building an ancient Egyptian one as we speak.
That sounds great. Well, last not least, on the table, number one, it's classic fiction anthologies.
Right, yes. This is something I've only recently gotten into. Listen to me, gotten. I've been in America too long. around about 2008, with a role-playing game called Colonial Gothic, which comes from a small publisher in Chicago called Rogue Games. You may or may not have heard of it. It's set during the American Revolution, and it's a sort of blend of the television series Sleepy Hollow and movies like National Treasure and the Johnny Depp Sleepy Hollow film. It's the struggle for American independence, plus supernatural, scheming Freemasons, wizards, Native American shamans, monsters from folklore, and it's a lot of fun, and I was very intrigued by it. And I knew the author, Richard Ioria, because he was a longtime Warhammer fan, and we'd actually met on the Hogshead publishing booth at Gen Con years ago. So I did a few things for them along the way, and one of my great plans was to introduce a fiction line. And as part of that, I started researching the copyright-free, because that's the other meaning of classic, folks, the copyright free fiction of the era and shortlisted it. When I parted ways with Rogue Games, quite amicably, but despite all our efforts, the game never really sort of achieved critical mass. It's still going and it's still very good and has a small but vocal fan base. I won't say anything against it. But anyway, I took this idea. Then a strange sort of coincidence happened. Are you Grognard enough to know the name Lawrence Schick? He wrote a lot of D&D stuff in the 80s.
Yes.
I worked with him in one video games company, and he's now the lore master for, I think it's The Elder Scrolls. And he's a big Musketeer fan. Big fan of Musketeers and Swashbucklers. In fact, he taught himself French so that he could read The Three Musketeers in the original. And he is now undertaking the massive task of translating not just that, but all the other Musketeer stories, and there's a lot of them, for the first time in 100 years in a complete translation into English with, you know, modern English that reflects the energy of Alexandre Dumas' original prose, rather than being rather stuffy Victorian English that we're used to seeing. As part of that, to sort of get a toe in the water with a publisher, he put together a thing called The Big Book of Swashbuckling Adventure, which is a fantastic collection of classic public domain swashbuckling stories. There's the very first ever Zorro story in there. There's Captain Blood. There's the Scarlet Pimpernel. There's all your favorites. So I emailed him and said, how did you pull this off? Because I've got something similar here. So he put me in touch with his agent, who put me in touch with his publisher. And the result was a book that came out in hardback about this time last year and has just come out in paperback, called Colonial Horrors. And as I researched these stories, it occurred to me that the colonial era, you know, with all the witch trials and the Puritans and the sort of stifling nature of the religion, the unknown nature of the dark and dangerous woods outside, everything, all the crumbling buildings that you read about in Lovecraft, that's really the native soil of American Gothic fiction, in the same way that the crumbling castles and monasteries of Europe are the native soil of the European Gothic fiction.
It's interesting that you say that, because there has been a bit of a resurgence in movies, isn't there, in that vein of colonial horror. I'm thinking of films like The Witch, and
that's right.
Yeah, it's a particular brand of American folk horror that is different. It differs in atmosphere and mood than you would get in British folk horror.
Definitely, and you're right to call it a brand. I think it's sort of iconic. You know, when you see the colonial people and the village and the hear the Puritan elder start to speak, you know exactly what you're in for. The upshot is that early next year I've got another anthology coming out called More Deadly Than the Male. It's early pioneering women writers of horror. Got Mary Shelley, obviously, and some quite unexpected ones like Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin. She also wrote some horror stories. Yeah, it's been a very interesting journey just researching not just the stories themselves, but the history of the horror fiction, the particular contribution that that women have made to it, and how that was distinct from when men write horror.
That's I'm going to look out for those. That's great, Graham. Hear what your opinion is of this renaissance of Wolfruff in the context of RuneQuest being reprinted. Where do you think this comes from, and how do you feel about the current state of play for the hobby?
I'm quite optimistic. I was at Gen Con this year. There's an award called the Diana Jones Award, and for those who don't know about it, it's something that is an informal sort of a thing awarded by people from within the industry in various categories for whoever has been the most influential in expanding the hobby and furthering the art and craft over the past year. And this year, the winner was the actual play movement, the sort of general term for all of those people who are live streaming or podcasting or vidcasting their play sessions. This, I hadn't realized what a big thing this had become. Role-playing games as a spectator sport and, you know, people sharing their play sessions online has become a huge thing, and I think this is part of what has reawakened the interest in role-playing games. And as you've said, RuneQuest is coming back. sadly now without Greg Stafford. He'll be very greatly missed. Vampire the Masquerade's getting a new edition, and so on and so forth. D&D 5 looks like it's going to go well. Pathfinder 2 is in testing, I think, now. So, yeah, there's a lot going on. We'll have to see whether this renaissance lives up to its original promise, but it's looking very, very good so far.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for giving us such a wonderful tour of your career. Come back in the future when you're doing more work, more great work. But until then, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you.
White Dwarf!
Woofrup, the adventures. With the release of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplaying at the back end of 1986, Games Workshop gave the scenario writers of White Dwarf a rich, atmospheric setting in which to immerse their adventures. The grimy, crime-ridden streets of the Empire were tailor-made for intrigue, mystery and conflict. Looming large in the background, of course, casting its accursed shadow, was the Enemy Within campaign. This epic quickly grew to epitomise the approach and theme of the game as a whole, the insidious, hidden corruption of society by the malign forces of chaos. I think Games Workshop realised that they were onto something special with this campaign, and I imagine the Nottingham studio was a hotbed of plans and ideas, so much so that these themes and ideas spilled over into many White Dwarf scenarios. If they weren't directly tied to the Enemy Within campaign itself, they were heavily influenced by it. The first two proper adventures out of the gate were Night of Blood by Jim Bamborough and Eureka by Paul Hargreaves. Jim Bamborough, of course, was one of the main writers of the Enemy Within campaign, so Night of Blood, despite its relatively simple setup, is dripping with atmosphere and redolent of the unmistakable stench of chaos. During their travels, the player characters are caught outside at night as a fierce storm closes in, with the perilous beasties abroad to ensnare the unwary traveller. What are the player characters to do? Luckily, the hooded man inn offers shelter. But are the innkeeper and his retinue who they claim to be? And just what is going on down in the cellar? The adventure was a great introduction to the main themes of Woofrup, and gave the players an early indication of the kinds of perils they would come to face in the Empire. The lonely inn, surrounded by an ominous forest, while the storm raged outside, also reminded me of Hammer Horror and gave the scenario a very distinctive feel. It was also elevated by some evocative artwork from the great Russ Nicholson, whose distinctive style perfectly suited Woofrup. Are you listening, Cubicle 7? The corruption in Eureka, meanwhile, was of the human sort, as the PCs were hired as bodyguards to defend an eccentric inventor from the threats of a well-connected protection racket. While this adventure felt a bit scripted in places, nevertheless, there were some good opportunities for some madcap chases, and the characters could have fun investigating the various Heath Robinson-like creations of Herr Wolfgang Krugelschreiber. A joke for our German-speaking listeners there. The finale was a neat twist on the Gringles pawn shop, with the play characters having to sneak out of a house, evading the attackers trying to break in. And then, in issue 94, came a real masterpiece. Graham Davis's A Rough Night at the Three Feathers. Over one tumultuous night, seven different storylines collided in the Three Feathers Inn, with a host of different characters rushing from one part of the inn to another. This had elements of a British farce, but instead of Brian Ricks with his trousers round his ankles, we had nobles engaged in illicit affairs, smugglers, thieves, chaos cultists, of course, bounty hunters, and a legal retinue en route to a trial by combat. More or less all of human life in the Empire. A proposed timeline for the night was given, with multiple plot lines meshing together like precision clockwork. However, there was no chance of the player characters just being passive observers to the events. Now, plenty of hooks were given to pull the player characters into the action. Indeed, Graham Davis
positively encouraged the GM to throw a spanner, in the form of the PCs, into the works, to make interesting things happen. There was an abundance of riches here. Running all seven plots at once required a skillful GM to manage, but even just putting two or three together made for a very satisfying adventure setup, and gave the scenario a high level of replayability. And, of course, this being Graham Davis, as well as a quality adventure, you could always count on the appearance of a gnome, and some fantastic names, top of the pile being Baron Otto von Dammenblast. The format of the adventure, eschewing the usual map plus room descriptions formula, and instead employing a timeline with accompanying NPC descriptions, seemed innovative at the time and appeared to be quite influential. Several subsequent Wolfram scenarios in White Dwarf used the same structure. A classic. It's no surprise that the scenario is being revamped and reissued for the new 4th edition of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay. Matt Connell and Jim Bamber combined a couple of issues later to bring us Mayhem at the Mermaid, a barroom brawl for Wolfram, and this appeared to be something of a White Dwarf tradition, following in the footsteps of Lewis Pulsifer and Michael Kuhl, this time with a brawl decamped from Apple Lane to Altdorf. The inn provided plenty of tables, chairs and other assorted furniture for characters to use as improvised weapons. Although this being Wolfram, even the armed with a large table, they probably still spend most of the time swinging and missing. Plenty of the characters were provided, each with a juicy motivation to allow players to indulge in some over-the-top role-playing in between the mindless violence. My favourite was the noble who'd come out for an evening's entertainment of insulting commoners. I have to say, though, I don't remember the text being quite so small when I read it 30 years ago. With the Enemy Within campaign proving so popular with gamers, it was no surprise that the next two Wolfram scenarios in White Dwarf were both set within that campaign. The Grapes of Wrath by Carl Sargent and Derek Norton was a follow-on from Death on the Reich and featured a nice, ripe plot of infidelity and familial revenge. Although this being Wolfram, the malign influence of chaos also meant the inclusion of floating skulls, making for a sticky situation for the citizens of Prittstock. The scenario was very well structured, designed to be easy for the GM to run. The town itself was like a mini sandbox, but the timeline, together with the PCs being up against a ticking clock, kept the adventure moving forward to an entertaining conclusion. Sad to note that at the time of writing this, Carl Sargent's death was announced. His reputation for writing quality RPG scenarios and later for authoring many fine solo game books will ensure that he's fondly remembered by gamers everywhere. Philip Wells's The Ritual was an alternative opening scenario for The Enemy Within. It was a heady brew of scaven, human cultists, bizarre rituals, daring rescues and high explosives, and did serve as a great introduction to Wolfram, covering as it did so many of the touchstones of the game. It strikes me that just as the presence of brew or Morakanth in an adventure mean that you can only be in Glorantha, so the scaven instantly transport you to the dank sewers of the Empire, filling your nostrils with the stench of rot and chaos, as the heart of society is slowly being gnawed from the inside out. Once again, some sublime and at times gruesome Ross Nicholson art added to the atmosphere and meant that this was an adventure not to be missed. Many people see issue 100 of White Dwarf as the turning point when the magazine turned its back on RPGs and fully embraced the more lucrative wargaming miniatures market. Cue exclamations of "The Great Betrayal" from assorted grognards. That issue, though, did include a hefty Wolfram scenario, The Floating Gardens of Barb Elon by Basil Barrett. Written for a competition run on Games Day 1987, This was a departure from the Wolfrup scenarios that had gone before. Set in Lusteria, the old world South America, it had the PCs playing a band of pygmies. It was the 80s, I suppose, investigating the floating gardens of the eponymous mage. As you can probably tell from the title, it was played mainly for laughs, with the puns dialed up to 11. But there was still opportunity for some good role-playing, particularly with the two rival shaman in the party, neither of whom could acknowledge the other in any way. The adventure itself was an against-the-clock dungeon crawl, and was pretty tough with it. A sign of the times, though, it was designed to be played with Games Workshop's dungeon floor plans, and if the scenario didn't exactly insist that you brought them, it hinted at it a few times. Games Workshop? Hard sell? Surely not. It always struck me that with some effort from the Games Master, this adventure could be diverted from its jokey tone and recast as an investigation into the tantalising hints left behind by the ancient mysterious race, the Old Slan. But then again, everyone likes a good pun. Post issue 100, Wolfrup scenarios did still appear amongst the Warhammer 40k and Blood Bowl. But reading these issues now, you can see that Wolfrup was slowly but surely being phased out. The writing was on the wall. One sign of this was the introduction of complete encounters. These weren't full scenarios, but more of a NPC and setting combination to be used as an adventure seed. They contained some nice ideas, but lacked the heft of a full-blown scenario. It felt as though something was lacking. And after publishing half a dozen or so, they were dropped from the magazine completely. Oh well. At least in one of them, Carl Sargent gave us the memorable gnome detective, Alphonse Hercules de Gascoigne. Two further proper scenarios were released. The Affair of the Hidden Jewel by Lewis Page did what it said on the tin, as the PCs hunted down for a stolen jewel, encountering various wanted outlaws as they did so. Enjoyable enough, but scripted in places, and the storyline made several assumptions about what the players would think. A dangerous, as experience would indicate, players hardly ever think what you'd expect. And Graham Davis gave us one more adventure. There's a one-eyed fellow hiding in the south of Katmandun. The scenario was built round the Furmer, an interesting creature from the rulebook that was largely underused elsewhere. This gave this adventure a distinctive and welcome edge, and the setting, misty marshes west of Middenheim, was atmospheric. Defending the nearby village added a magnificent seven flavour to the proceedings, even if it was suggested that, block your ears, role players, you handled the conflict using the Warhammer Fantasy Battle rules, hint hint, available from your local Games Workshop store. And so, to the last issue of White Dwarf I bought, 106, and one final surprise of Wolfrup solo adventure. As far as I'm aware, the only one published for the first edition. Night of Mystery was written by Carl Sargent and involved you tracking down a stolen item in the village of Grimminghagen. The familiar fighting fantasy structure was used with an added race against time mechanic as an extra feature. Could you find the stolen relic before the village was overrun by extremely unpleasant dead stuff? All of the staples of Wolfrup were present and correct. Plenty of suspicious villagers, the unmistakable taint of chaos, and several ways for your character to come to a grisly end. Highly enjoyable, with some evocative illustrations by Paul Bonner to complement the narrative. This was a fitting final word for Wolfrup in White Dwarf. Yes, I know that technically there were features in later issues, but I didn't buy them, so they don't count.
Open box! Welcome to Open Box, part of the podcast where we look back to look forward. Last time we opened the box with Graham Davis. This time I'm with Blythe. Hello, Blythe.
Hello, Dirk.
Warhammer. Open the box. It's difficult for us to open the box because it's not a game that we play.
We didn't have the box.
We didn't have the box.
Or the book. Well, I did have the box, didn't I? I had the first, I had the very, 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 very first Warhammer, the tabletop Warhammer, didn't I?
Yeah.
I bought that and was underwhelmed by it.
And that's the one that has the great John Blanche
cover. Yeah, the cover's good. The box cover's great. I think that's probably what seduced me into buying it when I was, I don't know, what would I have been? About 15 or something like that?
Yeah.
But the game inside was very, very disappointing, I felt.
Yeah, it was like typeset differently than the other.
Yeah, look, it was like three booklets. They did the kind of traveller model, didn't they? three black booklets, and this wasn't so much the look. I think it was just the fact that it was essentially a tabletop war game. It wasn't a role playing game, but there was this odd role playing element tagged on where you could play a character within a battle, I think.
And the only thing I remember of it is it had a joke in it about Lychin, you know, the little stuff that you throw
the
railway
the weird, yeah, the green.
About reindeers stuff. Eating it because it's in proliferation. And
is that right?
Yeah.
I thought there'd a reindeer near your model railway then. You've had it.
And I remember the scenario being the Ziggurat of Doom.
Yeah. I think that's a sign of a poor game. If the only thing you can remember is a joke that was in it. I mean, you know, not a very good one at that. But it was an odd game. And in fairness, it didn't. Now we've played Warhammer, new and old, yeah. It doesn't bear much resemblance to Warhammer, the role-playing game. But it was a disappointing game, I think, the very, very first one for me.
Yeah, here I've got in front of me here, White Dwarf 82, October 1986. Anybody? Yeah. Inside, there's a pullout with all the illustrations from the book, and it's saying that it's forthcoming. It's going to be $14.95, and it's got this description here. Anybody?
A game in which the player characters are plunged into a brooding medieval world where nightmares come true. And malignant entities stalk darkened streets. Now, that description is right up our darkened street.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
So, how come we've remained immune to it for so long?
I think it's more than this, but I think part of it was because that first incarnation of it, the tabletop incarnation, was so disappointing. In my mind, I thought that the role-playing game would be very similar to that and would therefore be equally disappointing. I think that very first version of it put me off a bit. I think it runs a bit deeper than that, but that's certainly part of it for me.
Yeah.
I kind of thought, $14.99, is it going to be as rubbish as that box one that I bought?
And it seemed very associated with miniatures as well, didn't it?
Yes.
I don't think I entirely differentiated between the fantasy battle game and the role-playing game.
Yes.
I did think it was all about miniatures.
Yes, that's part of it as well. That we'd long since given up on using miniatures because we used the
Theatre of the Mind.
It was more about figures. Yeah. And there was a kind of weird blurring of, as you say, tabletop battle games and the role-playing game in our minds.
Yeah.
So that was part of it. I think it ran... But there were other things as well, though. By then, we were settled on our games, weren't we?
Yeah.
We were settled on our games, and if someone had given you $14.99, the first question you would ask is, why don't you just give us 15 quid?
Yeah.
Round it up. But if they'd given you $14.99, you or I would not have bought that game. What we would have spent it on is a supplement for RuneQuest or Stormbringer or Traveller or whatever else. And I think by then we were playing quite a bit of advanced D&D.
Advanced D&D,
we were playing that. So I think we would have spent it on something for those games we were settled on rather than a new game.
See, I have a different memory of this than you because I think that this...
Are you suggesting memory is unreliable?
I am suggesting it is unreliable.
That is a very... Yeah. That's a bad thing. Don't mention that in this podcast.
I think By this time in the autumn of 86, I was working. You were at college.
Mm, yeah.
I probably had
£14.95.
Yeah.
And I wasn't spending it on that. I was spending it on beer and trying to find a girlfriend and on records.
Spending £14.99 and trying to find a girlfriend.
Oh, going to places
did
where I may...
Did he want more money than that?
Well, going to places where that may happen.
Yes, there was a bit of that going on as well.
Yeah.
Yes, by the life point, outside gaming.
Yeah, we kind of we moved away from that part of it. The other thing that, you know, having played the game, and we'll talk a bit about that a bit more, is that the most appealing thing is the setting, isn't it? The medieval, grim and dark setting.
Yeah.
That was our default setting for everything anyway.
It was really, yeah. We like things gritty, miserable, grim.
Yeah.
I mean, whether because we're playing in Bolton, I don't know. Maybe there's something going on there.
Yeah. I think that's like, even our Glorantha had dirt underneath its feet.
Yeah.
And it was gritty.
Yeah, it wasn't kind of... Mythic. We weren't hero questing, were we? Or
no.
Anything like that. It was more
grim,
clanking
dark,
around,
dirty,
murdering lunar soldiers in the dead of night kind of thing, wasn't it?
And when our default setting for Tunes and Trolls was much the same way.
Yeah.
And at this point in 86, this was when we were doing the Postal game, and that very much was a medieval setting, wasn't it? Using the RuneQuest system. So, you know, the most appealing bit of Warhammer is its setting. But it was already a setting that we were familiar with.
It was, yeah. But going back to your point, I mean, what your memory of it and my memory of it are actually very similar in the sense that because, you're right, we were playing, we were doing things outside of gaming, spending our money on other things, but we were still gaming, and it was a case of, because we were doing other things, we didn't have room for another game. We had our games that we were playing, and we didn't have room for something else. I couldn't be bothered. I suppose I couldn't really be bothered learning the rules. It was that thing you look at a big rule book and think, oof, you know, another one. Well, I've learnt the rules to these games, and that's what we're doing. There's no room for anything else. So you're right, it was about doing other things, but equally, because there wasn't room for another game, because we were doing other things.
No, we played it. We played two editions. We played the first edition, the first part of the Enemy Within campaign, Mistaken Identity.
Yeah.
And we also played the fourth edition.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the first edition and how that went and what your thoughts on that.
I enjoyed the scenario, Mistaken Identity. I thought that was a nice little scenario. No spoilers, but with some nice twists in it. And you can see, perhaps, back in the day, how people would have really liked that adventure.
Yeah.
I don't know if innovative is the right word, but it plays around with your expectations, I think.
Yeah. The innovation certainly comes from the construction of the adventure rather than the mechanics of the rule set.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we talked about the rule set in some detail last time, didn't we? But
to
me, it's always been the case that it's a game that emerged from everything that was existing at that time.
Yeah, it's a sort of Frankenstein's monster game, isn't it, that borrows from lots of other games.
Yeah.
Percentage systems, hit locations from sort of basic role playing.
So it's a bit like progressive rock in the 70s. Took all the elements that were and went with it. So, you know, you've got... you know, you've got the career system from travel emerging with the with elements of D&D all blended in.
And of course a bit of Cthulhu as well.
Yes,
because of course it's the grim, dark, unspeakable horrors lurking in dark alleys and that kind of thing, and magic being seen, viewed with suspicion. All those sorts of things are very much.
And that's something I was not aware of until we started playing.
No, I wasn't really. I just thought it was a standard fantasy game with a bit of a slightly dark, grimy setting, but not. But the Cthulhu thing comes across quite strongly, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Very dangerous as well. Very deadly game.
Yeah.
You know? Which, again, sort of comes from RuneQuest, although it's more deadly because people don't have healing. But having played it, I suppose it begs the question, do we feel now that we missed out? And a little bit of me thinks perhaps we did a bit.
Yeah.
Because I think we would have enjoyed it. I think we would have really enjoyed it. I think we were put off for all those reasons we've just discussed. But I think if we'd bought it and played it, we would have enjoyed it at the time.
Yeah. So it's available now, isn't it? So we played the fourth edition.
Yeah.
With an adventure of Gaz's devising. Mm. But with similar elements to the Enemy Within campaign, because felt...
Yeah, it's got like twists and turns in it, and things that you're not expecting, yeah.
And very much lots of sausages involved.
Lots of sausages, yeah. And it's similar, it is very similar, it's not hugely different, is it?
No.
It does a kind of more, the resolution is more of a sort of a pause roll thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Degrees of success, isn't that, rather than just a straight... For the first edition game, it seemed like it's just a straightforward percentage system, isn't it?
Yeah.
But in the newer version, it's percentages, but the degree of success versus the opponent kind of thing. Which makes it a bit more, made it feel even more deadly, actually, because my character, I think, got a really good level of success against a guy who got a really bad roll, and he was basically gone in one round. He was just run through, wasn't he? And that was the end of that.
Yeah.
You know, so it makes it more deadly in a sense.
Yeah, because I think we didn't experience this playing the first edition game, but I know that people have reported that combat would go on and on and on and on because you're doing that to-ing and fro-ing, but there was none of that in the fourth edition.
No,
as you say, because it's in a pause roll, and you could actually fail and still succeed
to some extent,
because your opponent might fail worse than you, therefore you turn that failure into success. So combat was over quite quickly.
Yeah, it was over quickly, and that degree of success resolved that problem of a percentage that you keep missing.
Yeah.
So being 35% with something is not very good. But if you're fighting someone who's got 35% and it's in a pause roll, it resolves much quicker. But it's not huge. I don't think it's hugely different. It didn't feel hugely different as a game. It's felt very much along the same sort of continuum, if you like.
And what I think came out of it, and we've mentioned the setting previously, were... I'd always seen it as a generic setting. It is actually quite tightly defined in its way, isn't it? It's more European. It's a particular point in time, isn't it?
It's particular, yes. And that somehow, the system and the setting go very well together, because that brutal, deadly combat system somehow fits in with this rather brutal, deadly, grim world.
Yeah.
And it's not, it isn't.
What surprised me was its comic tone. So it deals with the grotesques, doesn't it? But it doesn't set out to be humorous. It's just the way that it frames things.
To some extent that, I mean, again, putting it in the context of back in the day, that you could argue that's one of its strengths, that it was a fantasy game that was the opposite of D&D. So it's like D&D, but through the looking glass almost, where everything isn't quite as it should be. But I think back in the day, we assumed, Games Workshop have invented a bog standard fantasy game. And I don't think it is bog standard. I think it's a very, it's very much its own thing, isn't it? As you say, the settings sort of feels very distinctive.
Yeah.
And the mechanics are quite well suited to the setting.
Having played it now, and you say, you know, have we missed it?
Mm.
Can you see us playing it? Because this is the thing that struck me about it, that, you know, we're in a position now, aren't we, Blythe, where, you know, we've been doing this podcast for 3 years.
Mm.
Okay. What's becoming apparent is that our gaming time is finite. We're pushing it to the limit, the amount of gaming we can get in.
Yes.
Yeah?
Mm.
And without serious FPO explosion, we are at risk of pushing our luck too far.
Yes, true.
Yeah. So when we're going through and charting a course through the past, we've been dealing with stuff that we're familiar with, and we're uncovering treasures
Mm. No, we didn't play. So we've got this one, this game. And I'm quite keen to add it to our repertoire.
Yeah. I've enjoyed it, yeah.
But how can we?
It's the opposite of the 80s. Well, instead of going out looking for girls, we're trying to avoid them. Or avoid their wrath.
Or women.
Doesn't have to be a girl. Doesn't have to be a woman. Could be a man. But in our case, it's a woman.
Yeah.
Just for the sake of...
Well, we are on the internet, aren't we?
Yeah, that's true. Yes. So, yeah. I know what you mean. There is that problem of... And also, not just... I mean, even if you can find the time to play a game. So you can find the time to play lots of games. There's always that question, isn't there, of depth and breadth, isn't there?
Yeah.
So you could play. Yeah, we could get a couple of games of Warhammer in next year, I'm sure. But do you really feel you experience it properly if you only play a couple of games of it?
Yeah.
You know, part of the attraction with all... I always say this, but part of the attraction with all role-playing games is the fact that you can play them over a long period of time, and you can do campaigns, and you can do play the same character for a long time and develop a character. But of course, the longer you're doing that, you're just playing one game.
Yeah.
You're not playing a breadth of games.
So how do you spend that finite resource of gaming time that you've got, and plan a course through all the past that we're discovering?
Mm.
And the stuff that's coming. So already, we've, over the last couple of months, got a new RuneQuest, new Warhammer coming in. So with all that stuff out there, how you make... There is too much. It's a case of be careful what you wish for.
Yes.
Because back in the 80s, we had this hunger and desire for new stuff to come out so that we could get it. But now it's just everywhere.
Yeah. I think the answer is just don't buy any of it. Just don't buy it. Ignore it. Ignore all the Kickstarters. Ignore all of it. Ignore all of it. Stop. Just stop now.
But it's difficult to ignore, isn't it? It's difficult to
ignore. Of course it is, yeah.
It's just difficult to ignore because discovering Warhammer and this desire to play it has made me reflect. You go onto DriveThruRPG and you've got everything there.
Everything's there, and more to the point, everything's there at a reasonable price. So you can get a PDF relatively cheaply and suss a game out, can't you?
That
as well. So you don't have to pay 40 or 50 quid for the hardback. You can pay 15 quid or $14.99 perhaps for the PDF. And that's very tempting because you then want to dip your toe in lots of things. And so, in some ways, you see... Cost is a factor, isn't it? And if a game's very, very expensive, so it's like the new version of Numenera. They've done a new version, and I think the slipcase with two volumes is about £100-odd. Now, sorry, Monty Cook, I ain't going to be buying that. That's a lot of money. I'm not going to be buying it because I've got Numenera, I've got the first edition, I'm fine with it. But if new game, ironically, that's maybe not a bad thing because it stops me buying it. Whereas if things are cheap and accessible on DriveThru as a PDF, I might be tempted to have a look at it. I might look at that, before you know it, you're getting excited about a new game.
Yeah.
And you've got the time to play it.
And as we said, we buy stuff to play it.
Yeah.
But when there's everything that's ever been done and new stuff appearing...
Yeah.
How do you start with that?
I don't think you can. The thing is, you can't, can you? It's a simple fact. You have to find a way to steer a course through it one way or another. Yeah. I'm not sure how, but whether you are, weird rules. I'm going to buy one new game a year, something like that, two new games a year.
Well, this is the thing I think is part of the reason why people are drawn to the nostalgia that we cover in this podcast, because people are nostalgic to a time where it was curated for you. So you might be furrowing the same area. So White Dwarf would be telling you that this is the game to play.
Yeah.
And people would go to it because it'd been picked.
Yeah, it's been hand-picked for you,
Yeah. And you knew that it was, it was there.
You trusted them. I mean, maybe you shouldn't have done, but generally you trusted White Dwarf to provide you, as you say, curate and provide you with, this is worth playing, this is worth, you know, worthy of your attention sort of thing. I mean, as we've discovered doing these podcasts, that it's kind of untrue, because it was a house magazine. They were essentially saying, we stock this. This is good because we stock it. This isn't so good, but we don't stock that. So ignore that because we don't stock it. Buy this because we stock it. So, yeah, it wasn't really like that, but you're right, it felt like that. It felt like you were being offered things. And I suppose you could argue you're being charitable, so let's be charitable. You could argue that they stocked it because they thought it was good.
Yeah.
They stocked it because they thought it was worth stocking, as opposed to things they didn't stock that they thought, like, perhaps not that good. So even if White Dwarf was kind of peddling what they stocked, you're right, it was still giving a kind of seal of approval of sorts.
I don't mind being reassuringly manipulated. I think that's what I'm saying. And I think part of the difficulty... Part of the difficulty now is you don't quite know who you're being manipulated by. So
that's never pleasant.
No.
I like to know who's manipulating me.
Exactly. So
even if they're doing it in a reassuring way.
In an internet environment. There are people telling you what to play, aren't they?
Mm.
You know, Kickstarter.
Oh, yeah, there's the world's... And also full of sort of idiots like us, I suppose, on podcasts telling you what they think of things.
Yeah.
With absolutely no expertise whatsoever.
Exactly. No critical faculties.
Critical faculties. No expertise. Just a pair of idiots.
You are being shown what's available.
Yes.
And a podcast
out
there.
Yeah.
And... Mm. But everybody's head is pointing to the same direction.
Yes, the latest thing, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. You do. You get these periods on social media and here and there where something comes out and everyone's like, ooh, this is good, isn't it?
This is good. Yes, this is great. Then, this is a must-have.
Yeah, and then till next week, and then suddenly it's not a must-have. And everyone's moved on.
Yeah, I was thinking of like Blades in the Dark last year.
Yeah,
Blades in the Dark came out. And it was like a flurry of, you know, everybody's going to play. Let's interview the people who produced it. Let's, look at it. Oh, and Twitter was alive with it. Look at that. And then it burnt out.
Mm.
And you can point to loads of things, can't you?
And that's the problem with it. There's a kind of disconnection between the experience that is being pushed at you or you're experiencing on social media or on the internet or wherever, and your own personal experience. So it's like, say, with Blades in the Dark. Blades in the Dark's a good little game, and there's a lot of material in it, and you could play it for a long, long time with a group of friends. And so that initial excitement about it that then peters out, if you've got the game, you can still be playing that. Just what I mean is that there's a kind of twin track thing, isn't there? That everyone's talking about the latest thing, but you bought the latest thing 6 months ago, and you can still be playing that and enjoying that.
Yeah.
In a perfectly legitimate way. There's like a disconnection between what's going on in the world of gaming. Let's call it the world of gaming.
Yeah.
And what's going on at your kitchen table on a Friday night playing a game with your friends.
Yeah.
Because what you're playing might not be the thing that the world of gaming is raving about.
Yeah.
And this is what I said earlier. I think you have to make a decision, don't you, to say, no, I like this and I like that and I like this, and I'm not going to let my head be turned constantly. Because if you did, I don't know what, you'd just be buying stuff all the time and never really playing anything for that long, would you?
No.
And that, in a way, that you're missing out on one of the joys of role-playing games, because a role-playing game has that playability, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You can keep playing these things for a long, long time, and there's all sorts of permutations about how you would play them, what character class you play, what kind of adventure you're doing, all that kind of stuff. But that sits at odds with this constant head turning of, here's the latest thing, here's a new thing, here's another new thing. Why don't you back this thing? It's a new thing. But in a way, that's not what role playing games are really how they work, is it?
So
great role playing games are games that you will play for a long, long time with your friends. Same game.
So maybe the biggest service that White Dwarf gave us, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe the nostalgia isn't for White Dwarf handpicking what to play each month. It was the fact that they gave you they facilitated you playing it by providing scenarios and articles. You know, as Daily Dwarf covered in this for Warhammer, perhaps it exists beyond the rule book. You know, the people's experience of it was through the stuff that they gave you.
And in a way, that was the thing. That's what they did. They provided scenarios and articles and clarifications and new ideas for a relatively small set of games. AD&D, RuneQuest, eventually Cthulhu, Traveller.
And at this time, like Paranoia.
A bit paranoia, but not much. And they would provide you with lots and lots of material for a relatively small number of games. But in a way, I suppose it's the cleft stick, isn't that the right phrase, that the role-playing industry has always found itself in. You know, it's always found itself in that situation where you only need this game, you only need this rule book, and you can go away and play this game for a long, long time without buying anything else. So it's got that problem, hasn't it, of it's either got to sell you lots of supplements, or it's got to create a new game that sounds exciting, more exciting than the one you're playing. Buy this one instead. Not a game you're playing, you've been playing for a few weeks or a few months. Well, there's something new come along that looks even more exciting, so why don't you buy this? The industry has to create things. You can understand that, can't you? Because they're not going to stay in business if they don't.
Yeah. Or reissuing old classics.
But I do think from a personal perspective, you've just got to try and find your way through it, haven't you?
Yeah.
And make decisions that I'm just not going to buy some of this stuff. Unless you collect them. Some people do, don't they? They collect them, and that's fair enough. But if you're interested in playing them and you're buying them to play, I certainly always look at a new game and think, would I play this?
And
also, not just would I play it, but I do think cost comes into it as well.
Yeah.
And the way it's... So you do get games that are produced and they're quite expensive. And I know I take the point that I think Gaz made when we were at Expo, talking to Gaz at Expo. You can pay 50 or 60 quid for a game. You can pay 50 or 60 quid to watch a gig these days, and it's over in an hour and a half.
Yeah.
So it's, in a sense, it's value for money. But it still mounts up, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Particularly if you spend £50 on a rule book, and then there's another £30 on another supplement that you think, well, that's kind of essential. And then they release another one at £30 and another one. And before you know it, you feel you've got to buy all these things.
Yeah.
That's a factor in deciding whether to buy a new game. Whereas going back to Blades in the Dark, Blades in the Dark's one book, 25 quid. And that's really all you need.
Yeah.
And there's other games like that as well.
Yeah, because it's in a similar position we were in 1986. There are other demands. You know, you can say that it's the same price of a gig, but I'm going to gigs as well.
Yeah,
so,
exactly. Yeah, yes, that's true. Yeah.
You know, if you allow it to consume your hobby budget and your pastime budget, it takes over, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. That's true. It's not like you're not going to gigs and not having a curry every now and again. You are hand buying the gigs.
That said, I have got the rule book. I bought the fourth edition.
Mm.
Did you know that?
I did know that, yeah.
Yeah.
You did mention it.
So,
I was thinking of staging an intervention, but I thought it's your money. Do we lie with it?
So I bought it. It means we're going to have to play it.
Mm.
So how does that feel?
Does that feel?
In our finite space of time we'll have in 2019, for example.
Yeah. I think the way we carve it up, it doesn't really bother me, because I think the way we carve it up is the decision is who's running the game, isn't it? So the games we play are defined by who's running it. So you'll run some games next year, and I'll run some games next year, and we'll both be involved in those games. But it's sort of the person running it says, well, I'm going to run this. And they're right, that's what we're doing then.
But given what you've said, let me phrase the question in a different way. The time we've got is finite to play. I've bought Warhammer 4th edition.
Mm.
What's going to be bumped? What would you, of my repertoire of
your
game,
repertoire?
Of my repertoire, what would you like me to bump to play that? Or would you say, no, don't play it next year?
I think of some of the rubbish you've run. I don't know. This is part of the problem. I like it too much. I like role-playing games.
You've got to make a decision.
I know that, but I like it all too much. I logged on to play Pulp Cthulhu when I was away for my wedding anniversary.
You did?
Yeah. And that's the man with a problem.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I said, oh, what the problem is. Is the problem role-playing, or is the problem that my wife didn't mind? I'm not sure. What's the bigger problem there?
So you were playing online from a hotel?
From a hotel room on my wedding anniversary evening, because I didn't want to miss out on the game of Pulp Cthulhu. That's I need help. So I'm not the right man to ask what can be bumped, because I don't know. All I would say is we're just trying to squeeze in Warhammer. We'll squeeze it in. You say time's finite. Is it? I'm not sure it is. I'm sure there's philosophical positions that say it's not.
Well, when we get...
Our time's finite, I'll give you that. But I don't think time's finite. If we can find a way of our time not being finite, we'll be okay. Essentially, immortality. Keep playing forever. It'll be no problem then.
Well, it's been suggested that we club together and use Patreon funds to invest in a retirement home called Dungroggin, where all the old grognards can get together and play these games.
That's more or less what we recreate at Grogmeet, isn't it?
Yeah. So, next time when we get together in the room of role-playing rambling, we'll be reflecting on the year and looking at the... year ahead. I might ask you this question again when it comes to New Year's resolutions.
About what I have to bump?
Something's got to give, yeah.
That's Psy World. Let's not play that. That looks rubbish.
But that looks brilliant.
It looks rubbish.
Until next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks once again to Graham for joining us. Talking to him now is much like reading him back in the day. I feel like I've learned something new and keen to run off in different directions, sourcing ideas and background material. Thanks too to the Smart Party for their help in putting this episode together. They may be releasing a Warhammer actual play session featuring me and Blythe. Make sure you subscribe to their feed if you don't already. In the next podcast, we'll also feature some sample play from our Enemy Within session, games mastered by Asaka So from Twitter. Warhammer will also be featuring in the third Grogzine, which is due out in January 2019, all being well, hard copies of which will be posted to patrons as a thank you for their support, wherever they are in the world. If you are subscribed as a patron at the end of November 2018, you'll get a copy. Don't worry if you subscribe later, as you'll have access to the PDF. The podcast will always be free to listen to. The Patreon campaign is to help to cover some of the costs and allows us to do other projects, such as the Grogzine. The higher tiers above $3.50 a month will also get some extras, such as the Collected Daily Dwarf Volume 3 and the all-new Judge Blythe Rules Book of Judgment. We're now actually getting perilously close to the next goal, don't tell Blythe, but it's an extra podcast episode where we discuss nostalgia, the details of games that we're currently playing. I'm sure we'll be fine with it if I ever get to that point. Thank you all for your generous support. It's really appreciated. And we've had some new recruits in September and October 2018, so I want to give a shout out to them. Joining up $1 a month is Jonathan Webb, Paul Blendell, Benjamin, and Barry Ryan. Thanks. For those over $5 a month, I like to roll them a virtual gift from a table from the game under discussion. This time, I'm going to inflict damage from the critical tables from Warhammer 1st Edition on their enemies. First, it's Norman Beresford. Okay, let's roll. And that is a body blow. Your blow lands with some force on the groin. Your opponent is knocked to the ground. Next is Joseph Wolfenden Williams. Oh, it's a head blow. Your blow strikes a point in your opponent's jaw, forcing the jawbone upwards into the lower part of the brain. Your opponent must test against toughness or lose 10 points from each percentage characteristic as a result of lasting brain damage. Nice. Next is Vidal Barros. Okay, Vidal. There's a sickening crunch as your weapon smashes the bones of your opponent's forearm. Anything held in that hand is dropped, and the arm below the elbow is incapacitated until medical attention is received. Okay, Chris Stevens has increased his pledge to $5. So let's have a look here. Okay, Chris, you've got a head as well, so your blow hits a neck, smashing the vertebrae. Your opponent falls to the ground and twitches for a couple of seconds and then lays still. We've had some new people who've joined at the upper levels. $7.50 from Adrian Kelly. Thanks, Adrian. Your target's arm is smashed and an artery is severed. Anything held in the hand is dropped and the arm is incapacitated until medical attention is received. At $10 a month, it's Jim Mosley. Thanks, Jim. You've got a body blow. Your blow smashes several ribs. Your opponent may do nothing for the next round. Okay. And finally, David Patterson. Oh, and you've got a head. Your opponent's head flies off in a random direction, landing 2d6 feet away. Thank you to all of you. When the zine goes out to the top level patrons, they'll get a certificate with their zine so they can show future generations what their virtual gift was. Now, if you follow me on Twitter, at the Grognard File, you'll know that we started recording this episode in a pub, but abandoned it because of the background noise, and we were talking complete gibberish thanks to too much ale. However, I wanted to share this moment from when we were discussing drive-through RPG, social media, and the Spotification of RPG.
The Quad Fleetwood Mac, you go your own way. Yeah. Find your own way through it. In the same way, Spotify's like, the music's like that, isn't it? If you've got all this music, what you've got to do is the onus is on you to say, hang on, I've got to find my way through this. Yeah, otherwise, it's going to just swamp me, isn't it?
But it's not, though, is it? It's not, though, because there's an algorithm pushing stuff your way, saying, oh, you want this?
Oh, yeah,
you want this?
There is.
I've noticed that you've looked at this, so you want this?
That is the voice of an algorithm, that. Well, yeah. That's how you imagine the algorithm. Yeah. I'm an algorithm.
You want this,
don't you?
Yeah. And it's the same with gaming.
Next time, adios, amigos.